Hey, parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Prevail, c'est un chatejneva programa pro politico.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimen organizado, dinero sucio.
Globalu corrupciu. Ta brotbu za demokratiu.
Y ahora,
ATP.
Et maintenant,
con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Gregoria.
Welcome, extra fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Arthur Snell is here. This is, I believe, Arthur's third tour of duty on the Prevail podcast. He joined the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in Britain after graduating Oxford with a first-class degree in history. He's fluent in Arabic, so he served in Afghanistan, Zimbabwe, Nigeria, Yemen, and Iraq. He was the head of the international strand of the UK government's Prevent Counterterrorism program. He's now a geopolitical consultant and the author of a book called How Britain Broke the World, which we talked about last time. He has a podcast called Doomsday Watch, which is excellent. And it's now in its different season. It's a new season. And what he's done here is presented a history of the war in Ukraine. So it's a different kind of twist on the usual stuff he does with the podcast. It's really, really good. If you want to know what's happening in Ukraine sort of as a historical document, I highly encourage you to download and listen to Doomsday Watch. Oh, and he also has a Substack. The Substack is called Not All Doom. Which I guess is going to have things in it that aren't doom related. We're excited for those. There wasn't as much doom on the podcast. We always have a good time chatting, and we talked about all kinds of stuff. We talked about Eurovision. We talked about Rishi Sunak. We talked about the coronation. We talked about the elections in Turkey, which we recorded this a couple weeks ago, and the first round of elections is now over. And we're waiting on the runoff. It is looking like Erdogan's going to win, but we analyze that a little bit. Arthur analyzes that, breaks that down a little bit. And then the second half of the podcast is really about the war in Ukraine, what's going on there, what he thinks might happen, and what Europe might look like when all is said and done here. Pretty fascinating stuff. Really, really important. You know, this war is the primary event now of this generation. It just is. It's going to reshape the world in ways, you know, that we can't necessarily anticipate. So it's important to think about, to talk about, to keep in the public consciousness. I know it gets exhausting with all the doom and gloom, you know, the doomsday watch. But this is a super important story, and I'm going to keep bringing it to you. This is also the 100th episode of the Prevail podcast. Somehow. I've done 100 of these. I can't even believe it. It feels like yesterday. Actually, that's not true. I don't remember a time when I was not doing this. So I guess that's good. And to celebrate the 100th episode of Prevail, we're going to change the name of the podcast. It's now just going to be called Ale. I'm just kidding. That was a little, you know, if you have HBO Max, now suddenly it's Max all of a sudden. I don't know what fucking marketing team thought that this would be a good idea. Nobody that I talk to thinks that it is. You know, HBO is this brand that's been around forever that has super high approval ratings, in my view, you know, that sort of equates itself with really quality programming. And now we're just going to name it after a dog. I don't know. It seems weird to me, but what do I know? You know what else is weird? Paying $100,000 for Kevin McCarthy's used chapstick. I wouldn't pay $100,000 for used Kevin McCarthy. I don't know. These Republicans are weird, and they are dangerous, and they are trying to crater the entire global economy in order to cut taxes even more for their rich donors, which is evil. It's just patently evil. Kevin McCarthy is one of the dumbest humans. I don't know why we keep installing these dumb people into positions of great power and think that it's a good idea. I wish we would stop doing that. Maybe we should like not do that. Maybe instead of doing that, we should not do it. I'm just going to say, be better. All right, enough prattle from me. This is a great conversation. Arthur's one of my favorites. We always have a good time. So please enjoy this discussion with Arthur Snell.
This here's a story about rich old Berryside. Got a ton of cash to spend and even more to hide. $1.6 billion is what the fucker's worth. And he gave it all away to the worst people on earth. Gave $1.6 billion to Leonard Leo. He's with the Knights of Malta and with Opus Dei. He's the man responsible for overturning Roe. And Berryside gave the money to him. Fucker. So much dark money to run. So much dark money to run. So much dark money, I'm stunned. They got money, we got none. Oh, oh, no.
Arthur Snell, welcome back to Prevail.
It's great to be back, Greg.
Lovely to see you. I want to talk about your is it a season of the podcast? This podcast,
I think we can call it a season. Sounds a bit like Netflix, but you know, that's fine.
Yeah. I want to talk about that because I think it's really important work that you're doing over on the Doomsday Watch. Journalistically, at this point, it's really we'll talk about it later, but I wanted to, you know, right up front, if people are not listening to this and subscribing to it, go subscribe to Doomsday Watch because it's really such a great source for what's going on in the world, particularly now with this installment, this iteration, this season, a sort of history of Ukraine. So I want to talk about that. We're going to get to that later.
Okay.
First, I was looking at your Twitter before you came on, and I guess Eurovision is happening now.
It is. Yes.
Yeah. So there are certain things that happen in Europe that people in the United States look at it, we're like, what the fuck? We don't know what that means. So what's up with Europe? I didn't even know that Britain like participated in Eurovision. Well, do you personally have a rooting interest? Like, what's going on with everything?
Well, so Eurovision, unlike Brexit, the Brits are all in. and in fact, this year, Britain is hosting Eurovision. Now, that is normally an accolade that goes to the winner of the last year. But we are doing this for Ukraine. So Ukraine won last year. And for all the obvious reasons, they're not in a position to host it. So it's being hosted out of Liverpool. And so that's kind of charming. But then Eurovision, it's so weird. So the first thing that's weird about Eurovision is that there are plenty of countries that are nowhere near Europe that are in Eurovision. So just for one example, Australia is in Eurovision.
Okay.
Israel, which I suppose is a bit near Europe, is not that near Europe. And then you have sort of countries which are certainly on the edge of Europe, like Armenia's participating, Georgia, and then you know, countries you think of as very European, like, you know, France, Germany, Italy, whatever, they're all in it. But it's a crazy thing. It's sort of these weird kind of camp 3-minute pop songs, and sometimes they're kind of played for laughs and sometimes they take themselves very seriously. But it's a very kind of unique thing. And if your listeners, probably mostly in North America, are not familiar with it, then there's hours of fun on YouTube waiting for you.
I will say, a couple of years ago, I went away with some friends and there was I don't know if they won this year. I believe it was they were from, I want to say Moldova.
Ah, Moldova. Yeah, they're famously, you know, a very small and not very wealthy country, but they punch above their weight in Eurovision. They always have a great entry.
Yeah. This guy, I think it was Moldova. He played the saxophone in this little like solo thing, and somebody edited it so that there's a 10-hour clip, a just loop of this guy's sax solo. It's just called Epic Sax Guy Eurovision.
Epic Sax Guy.
And it's
he's a legend.
Yeah. We had it on in the background the entire time and nobody got sick of it. It's kind of amazing. You know, you would think that would be like some sort of,
you know, black site torture device to have to listen to this saxophone guy over and over. But no, it was actually cool. So Moldova, maybe Moldova is going to win again this year. Maybe, I don't know.
Well, I mean, I just before we started recording, they had done their entry. It was pretty weird, I have to say. But okay. Sometimes weird wins, you know, that's a great thing with Eurovision. There's some pretty crazy stuff has come good in the past.
Okay, good. I'm excited for it. I think I'm going to pay more attention to it this year. I need more camp and comedy and
well, there you go.
Artistic, well, you, cool
the,
stuff.
The first song of the evening is Austria's entry, and for reasons that I cannot begin to explain, is dedicated to Edgar Allan Poe. So, I mean, that is Eurovision all over.
quoth the judges, nevermore.
Yeah, indeed.
Right. Okay, so since the last time you were here, you guys, you crowned a king.
We did.
I happened to be up early that morning, and I watched most of the actual, you know, the ceremony.
Yes.
I tuned in during the part where they put like the sort of cubicle around him.
Oh yes. Looks
like from Office Space.
Really weird, that bit.
and I started to you know, to live tweet, because I'm like, nobody else is awake and you know, nobody's watching this. Yeah. I thought, you know, as spectacle, it was pretty fascinating to watch. Yeah. Like, people that are not familiar with coins don't know this, but there's a point at which in one hand he has what's called a globus cruciger, which is that orb with a cross on it.
That's
and
right.
He's got his scepter kind of resting on his knee, and he's striking this pose. And it's very intentional, because that's the pose that's on coins going back thousands of years.
Exactly.
On the reverse. And I'm like, is anybody else picking up on this? Is it just me? So what were your, where were you? You didn't go there, right?
No,
you were home.
No,
did you watch it? And what did you think?
Yeah, so I watched it at home. I mean, I had a fairly normal morning, you know, doing things around the house with the TV on. And I guess, like a lot of Brits who are, you know, you get people in Britain who are obsessed with the monarchy and who probably, you know, might go to the event, even if they're not on the inside, you know, but be in the crowd or might sort of get up especially early and put on their best suit or something. I'm definitely not in that category. But I'm definitely interested, and I'm a history major, so I sort of, the historic side of it certainly interests me. And I think that bit of it is so fascinating, because this ceremony has largely been the same since we're going back to King Edgar. So this is before William the Conqueror. Everyone's heard of 1066 and William the Conqueror, and that, you know, that's a long time ago. But King Edgar, I think he's in the 8th century, if I'm not wrong. So we're way back into the darkest depths of history. And it is quite bizarre. And as you say, the bit where they put up a kind of little barrier around the king so that they can then anoint him with magical oil. And that's to give him special powers. And that's quite weird, really, isn't it?
It looked weird on the screen. It's not good TV, I'll tell you that. That's for sure. Is it Edgar the Peaceful? Is that who it is?
I think that's right. Yeah.
I have a mug with the British monarchs on it for some reason.
Oh, well, look at you. You've got the mug. Yeah, okay.
959 to 975, Edgar the Peaceful.
Well done. I take my hat off to your extreme knowledge.
There were moments watching it that were funny. They had, you know, because it was on all morning, on all the news. Right. I was like watching one of the network shows. There was no commercials, and they just showed it all morning.
Amazing.
And they kept, every once in a while, they would go to one of the historians that they had, one of the, you know, who's British on.
Yeah.
And he said, well, thank God for William the Conqueror. I guess because he was the first person that did it at Westminster Abbey. But that,
yes,
just as a sentence. You know,
it's a great sentence.
It's
well, of course, maybe he didn't mention that when William the Conqueror got crowned, there was a huge riot because I guess the guy had just invaded England. So maybe quite a lot of people were still not on board with that. And most of London was burnt to the ground that day. So we may or may not thank God for him, but it was quite a difficult day for England.
You would think so. It was the funny thing to say. Yeah, he also said, this is slightly old-fashioned. He said,
slightly,
yeah. It's just slightly.
Just a
slightly.
1,000 years old-fashioned, yeah.
Yeah, so, okay, now, I'm looking at this. Charles, and I think just to even pull it off. I mean, most people, if you were sitting in a throne like that with crap, you'd giggle or something, you know. Yeah. It just, Camilla looked a little bit like she wanted to laugh the whole time, to be honest. But he did seem to pull it off in terms of, you know, he tried to present the gravitas and this and that. But I don't think he looked particularly well. You know, he looked like the crown's heavy and he.
Yeah,
kind of laboring.
He looked old. I thought he looked old.
Yeah,
and I mean, he is old. I think he's 74. So, I mean, as everyone has been saying for a long time, this is the guy who went through the longest, you know, apprenticeship scheme in history. He waited. Well, you know, he was a little boy when his mum was crowned, but you could argue that he's waited at least 50 years for this job, or 54 years maybe. Yeah, he now looks quite old. He looked, I agree with you, he looked kind of almost awestruck by what was happening. And I think quite emotional at some points. And I think, you know, fundamentally, because we live in a very sort of modern and cynical age, and there's plenty to be cynical about when you look at the British royal family. So, you know, that we can be critical. But he personally, I think, is an all-in believer, and therefore I suppose for him it was literally a kind of magical moment, or certainly a profoundly religious moment, and you could sort of see that in his face.
You could see he was kind of overwhelmed by it, and I think that's the right, you know, I don't think he did that on purpose. I think his reaction was authentic, but that is the right response, I think, to have. If you're not William the Conqueror, who's just killed Harold on the battlefield, and you're going to go crown, you know, and you're that kind of macho, whatever. If you're him, I think that's the way to do it. But it does, you know, watching the thing, I'm half, you know, again, like you, I'm interested in history and I'm interested in the spectacle and just to see how it's done. There's not been a coronation since 1953.
No,
a long time. So you know, what do they do? How are they going to do it? Part of me was fascinated and part of me wanted to laugh the whole time. So you know, and I think that's probably a lot of people's responses. But do you think we're going to have, is the monarchy going to go away ever? Or are we just going to have this for the foreseeable future? What do you think?
Well, I certainly think it's going to last a fair while. I actually thought, and I wonder, I think you and I might've spoken about this on previous podcasts, that I thought that King Charles would quite quickly run into difficulties because he does seem to have, you know, some character flaws, and you know, everyone's got character flaws, right? But I think he had a hard act to follow in that his mother was, whatever one might think of the monarchy and the institution, she was kind of personally unimpeachable. No one could kind of lay a glove on her. Whereas he does seem more human, and you can see that he's sort of lost his temper in public and things like that. And he has this sort of side to him which is a bit self-pitying, which again, for a man more born to extreme, you know, literally the most extreme privilege ever, is quite hard to sort of swallow. And so I thought that it was quite possible that his reign would go wrong quite quickly, that there'd be some, you know, thing where he expressed an opinion or he sort of complained that his life was so hard and everyone looked at him and said, what are you on about? But actually, so far, you know, he's undoubtedly, you know, that coronation, he seemed to get a lot of public support. So I think certainly for the medium term that they're set fair, you know.
Well, you know, we root in the United States for Britain to be powerful, a force for democracy and all this stuff. So it's odd to root also for the king, but you know, it's strange. The whole thing is odd, but
it is odd.
I guess we'll see what happens. Now, last time you were here, speaking of odd, it was during the brief Liz Truss interregnum.
Oh, I suppose. My goodness. So,
I think, you know, in order to schedule that, it was tricky because it really wasn't that much time.
That makes it a historically significant, you know, people will, when sort of archives of podcasts are a thing for future historians, they'll be able to click on that one as a special particular moment.
So she's gone, mercifully, I think. Now Rishi Sunak is the new prime minister. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get a bead on him. He seems, obviously, he's very wealthy. He seems to me to be, his out of touchness seems almost on par with the king's in a lot of ways.
That's right. Yeah.
what's your sense of him, and your sense and the sense in Britain in general, like the popular sense? Yeah.
So I think what he's like, I think Rishi Sunak is a type that many Americans may have come across, particularly if you're on the coastal bits of America, you know, a type who has been to elite universities, worked in Goldman Sachs or hedge funds, or, you know, maybe sort of big tech, somebody who is undoubtedly very bright, very intelligent, you know, very qualified, but has spent their entire life, literally every bit of their life, surrounded by people at that sort of top level elite, you know, and every aspect of their interaction with the world comes at that level. And they've just got really no conception of kind of what normal is. And I'm sure there are people like that in America, that if you flew them from their sort of Fifth Avenue apartment to somewhere in middle America, they'd be very confused and lost. And Rishi Sunak is that guy in Britain, that if you took him out of his sort of ultra privileged environment and take him to just some kind of normal, kind of boring little corner of England, he looks very out of place. And in fact, we've seen this as a politician, inevitably as a politician, you do have to at least play the part, you know, of trying to fit in with the ordinary guys for the photo calls and all that. And there's been several of those where Rishi Sunak looks like he really doesn't understand what's going on around him. And so I think that's the kind of the top line kind of view on him. But, and there is a big but, when you've come after Liz Truss, and as we just touched on there, you know, a short and very inglorious phase as Prime Minister, and then you've come after you know, she followed Boris Johnson, obviously, who was just chaotic. People look at him, and even the people who probably think, well, this guy's super rich and not like me, they can see that he's competent, he knows what he's doing, he's sort of capable. He's definitely not a drunkard. He's not, you know, I'm sure he's completely stable in his marriage and all those kinds of things that were just sort of chaotic in the earlier period have all gone away. So I think there's a bit of relief that there's just a sort of grown up back in charge. But that doesn't mean that he'd necessarily win the next election. It just means that I think in general, people are just happy that we're going to have the same prime minister for at least 2 years or something, and that would feel like a good run.
So okay, so that's, he is there for two more years minimally.
Well, right. So there's an election due next. Well, technically, because unlike yours, you know, they're not fixed; that they can be called at any time. But the limit on it would be this early in 2025.
Okay, right.
All the pundits are saying it's going to happen sometime next year. So he's back. He's actually got probably just a year and a bit, you know, maybe 15 months until the next election.
Is there any sense that Labour is going to win this time and be able to put somebody else as prime minister, or no?
No, I think there's a high chance they're going to win. They're riding high in the polls. Now, of course, you'll know very well that you know, out of the election period, often the opposition can look great in the polls, and then it all tightens up when you get to the election. But I think, I know that you have this concept in the US of the sort of the wave election, where people have just decided we're done with this, we're going to switch. I think we're set for something a bit like that in the UK, that people want to shift to the other side. You know, we've had 13 years of Conservative government,
right,
and most people think the country's in a mess. So you've got the Brexit thing that even supporters of Brexit look back and think, well, that wasn't what we planned for, you know, that we didn't deliver the promise that it gave. Right. The wider economy, I mean, obviously the global economy is in a difficult place with the effects of the Ukraine war and other post-COVID, so many other issues. But most of the statistics show that if you line up the sort of the wealthiest 20 economies in the world, the UK is performing worse than most of the others. So most of our peer countries that we should be roughly even with, we're slipping behind. And that appears to be a function of the Brexit in particular, but all, other aspects of the kind of conservative legacy, lack of investment in infrastructure, public services, things that, again, would be familiar from North America if you have Republicans in charge for too long. So we've got a lot of those things, and they come together, and people are fed up. You know, they want to shift. So I think it's very unlikely that Sunak would win the next election. But the big question is whether Labour would get enough to have a majority government, or right, they'd need some kind of deal. And this is where it gets more complicated. So we've the third party in British politics, the Liberal Democrats, which is probably ideologically closer to the Democrats. You know, it's not the Labour Party is technically a socialist party, albeit, you know, one that has drifted over the years, but it is certainly, that's its self-identity. And the Liberal Democrats is more of a kind of centrist sort of Clinton style political movement. And that, you know, that's waxed and waned over the years, but they're doing quite well at the moment. We just had local elections and they did really well. So a lot of people are now wondering whether Labour would need to rely on the Liberal Democrats to form a government, which, you know, is a more, in places like Germany, France, Netherlands, that's quite normal. But in the UK, that's a fairly unusual situation.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Yeah. And Sunak, what's his foreign policy like? Like, how is he on specifically on the Russia-Ukraine thing? Because it seems like it's good, but I just... You know.
Yeah, no, I think he is. I think right at the beginning, there was a bit of nervousness that this guy with a very kind of financial background, he's clearly very into kind of global big money. Maybe he would sort of be a bit soft on Russia. He likes the banking. He likes the financial services, all that stuff. And in fact, there were specific, I mean, this may not be fair or reasonable, but so Sunak's wife, I mean, he himself is very wealthy, but his wife is uber wealthy. She's from a Indian billionaire family, a guy who the father-in-law made billions in software services, Infosys, which, you know, is a huge software company.
Yeah.
And Infosys, I think, had a big, or maybe still does, but certainly did have a big business in Russia. And so there were all these allegations that he was going to be soft on Russia, but that hasn't happened. And I think, you know, I don't know what's his private internal opinion, but certainly that the government policy has stayed very firm. And in fact, just a couple of days ago, the UK announced it was sending Storm Shadow missiles. These are longer range missiles. And in fact, I think I'm right in saying that that's a capability that even the US hasn't yet given to Ukrainians. So in that sense, if you were looking just on the face of the evidence, you'd say that the policy is still very, very kind of firm.
That's good. That's good news.
And
I read that too about these missiles, the Storm Shadow missiles, because the Russians are really pissed off about it.
That's
RT
a good
lady,
sign.
Yeah. Margarita Simonyan threatens the UK. She wants to send, like, you know, more assassins there to do whatever.
Yeah.
And there seems to be rumblings there. There's so much Russian money, though, in London that it seems like maybe cutting off the nose despite the face in some ways with how it would work. I don't know.
It's interesting, this stuff with the Russians. They do have this sort of obsession with Britain, which I think is very historic, in the sense that at the time that the Russian Empire, you know, in the late 19th century was becoming a thing, obviously the southern boundary of the Russian Empire was jutting up against the British Empire in India and what is now Pakistan and Afghanistan and so on. So there was this kind of historic rivalry. But, you know, whatever we might think about the rights and wrongs of the history, you know, Russia is still an empire and Britain is not. You know, we're just that island on the edge of Europe. And but you still find this slightly obsessive tone with the Russians. And I saw the other day, Dmitry Medvedev, who, of course, back in the day was even president of Russia, albeit the kind of marionette president, you know, on Putin's string. And he was seen as a more liberal guy who at one point people hoped would lead Russia out of its kind of authoritarian phase. But he's now, since the events of last year, has gone hyper nationalist. And he threatened that Britain would be would be kind of drowned under a tsunami that would be created by some new Russian weapon. And it was just such an absurd, you know, it's just a kind of crazy threat that everyone in Britain was kind of making a big joke of it. It's like surfs up, you know, the Russians are sending us the best surf ever.
If it's Russian, it would be S-E-R-F, right?
Yeah, you're right. Yes, very good. Yes, I see what you did there.
based on their military capability so far, I don't know that they have any secret weapons hiding.
If they're keeping them very secret is all we could say.
Yeah, it's really a shit show. Like, I don't even know, you know, do they have nukes? Do they work? Like, does anybody know?
I mean, yeah, you don't want to test that, but I know what you're getting at. It's and actually, as a serious point, somebody I know who is a sort of technical expert, one of the things he said about the so-called tactical nukes, which, as you'll know, are these smaller scale ones, is that when every time you sort of shrink a nuke, the tech gets harder. It's harder to make it work, as a simple sort of point. And given what we've seen, as you've said, with, you know, the Russian weapons, it might be that the tactical nukes don't work at all. You know, that it's just that they work on paper, but they just don't work in practice.
Yeah. And I don't know. I just think, you know, again, it's a thorny issue because you want to, obviously it's a serious thing. If, you know, nuclear war is nothing to joke about, but
no,
just because he threatens it doesn't mean that everybody has to stop and pay attention to what he does.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's that classic thing of, you know, if you've been threatening nuclear war one way or another since about 1997, when the first expansion of NATO happened, and, you know, maybe people don't take you very seriously anymore.
Yeah. The boy who cried wolf. Yes. Your war. Yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah. We know that story by now. So we'll get back to Russia, Ukraine in a second. Actually, this is a good time to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Arthur Snell.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis' first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary.
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me, in a courtroom, how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, if I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized.
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Arthur Snell. We're talking about elections. There's a big election coming up in Turkey, which I know very little about. I know that I do not want Erdogan to win, but that's as much as I know. And I think the opponent has been threatened and is walking around with a bulletproof vest and heightened security there.
Yeah.
So what's going on in Turkey? What can you tell us?
Yeah. So President Erdogan has been sort of drifting in an ever more authoritarian direction, but also a more kind of Islamist direction over several years. And of course, Turkey, you know, has its foundation as a secular state. You know, most of the population are Muslims in their private lives, but it's had this secular sort of entity. And Erdogan has kind of ripped that up and become more authoritarian, but also basically become a very unreliable partner to Western countries. And of course, Turkey is in NATO, but they don't behave like they're in NATO. They bought a very high-tech Russian missile system a few years ago, which meant that probably Russia would have ended up gaining some kind of NATO intel that they wouldn't otherwise have had access to. During the attempt to get Finland and Sweden to join NATO, Turkey may have made that very difficult. Finland is now in, yep, but Sweden is still waiting. And that's solely because of Turkey kind of inventing really ludicrous obstacles. And in fact, most recently, Erdogan had said that he said there should be an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine, which people could say, oh, that sounds good. You know, we don't want to have a war. But of course, what that means is that Russia basically wins because they've seized a third of Ukraine. And then the ceasefire would give them that frozen conflict, which was really kind of what they look for. So Erdogan's a real problem. And within Turkey, he's been, increasingly authoritarian, making it very difficult for anyone to run against him in an election. But in spite of all of that, and people have been arrested, newspapers have been closed down, there's all kinds of harassment. In spite of all of that, he's actually behind in the polls to his main opponent. And this guy, who's a former civil servant, a very kind of mild-mannered guy who is representing a series of different parties. So he's literally sort of presenting himself as not a great sort of individual leader, but as someone who is a coalition, who is somebody, is almost a physical embodiment of a coalition. And as you say, he's got a huge amount of security defending him. He's been threatened with arrest and all kinds of kind of bogus legal charges and so on. Erdogan's behind in the polls. By the time most of your listeners hear this, we'll know kind of what the result was and how he behaved. The only thing I have felt is that this is an environment where you don't concede defeat. And of course, very sadly, I think, you know, we're living in a world where people have stopped conceding defeat in elections, and, you know, including, of course, very tragically in the US with Trump.
Yeah.
And I think Trump makes that easier. You know, imagine the US ambassador in Turkey trying to go and sort of get Erdogan to see reason sometime next week. You know, they'll just laugh them out of the room. And that's one of the many bad effects of Trump's behavior. Yeah, so I think Erdogan, he's got opportunities to rig the vote. He's got opportunities just to not concede. And he's got opportunities to force the Electoral Commission to kind of recount and do other things like that. But in spite of everything, a lot of Turks, who well-connected and well-informed Turks, do believe that he might lose. So I think it's going to be a really interesting sort of next 10 days, basically.
It would be great if he did. You mentioned Trump, and one of the things after Trump left that was discovered that was surprising to me is the foreign leader that Trump talked to the most was Erdogan, who called him all the time. They were like tight. And when he came to the United States, to Washington to visit, his guys roughed up protesters in front of the White House. And nothing happened, you know, nothing happened.
Yeah, just disgraceful, really.
Yeah, yeah, it was really, it was pretty awful. So that's, you know, that's who this guy is. And, you know, Turkey's obviously a super strategically important country, which is why it's in NATO. There's that, it's called the Rock. I forget the name of the name now of the city. There's this, it's high above the, you know, the mountains, and it used to be a big fortress in the Middle Ages. And it is now, because it's where planes take off and stuff like this, Air Force Base. So
is that, I think it's Incirlik.
That's it. That's it. So it's, you know, strategically very important. And if we get somebody there that isn't, you know, a Trumpy asshole, that would be super great. I mean, for Ukraine, for pushing back on Russia, for, you know, uniting NATO even more than it already has been united under, you know, since Biden took over. I think that the NATO has come together, you know, pretty remarkably, given that Trump tried to destroy it for 4 years.
Yeah.
He did his best. So, yeah.
You know, I agree. And I think it would, as you say, it would have a huge impact because, I mean, and it's even, you know, Erdogan is using a confrontation with the West as an electoral platform. Now, what's interesting, and I think this is why it's not working very well, is that most Turkish people, you know, they don't feel any reason to be in conflict with the West. So, so that, you know, it's, he's kind of picking the fight that most people don't want to be in. And of course, if Turkey's on the edge of Europe, if you're middle-class Turkish and you, you can visit Europe, you can go there and maybe you aspire to have your kids study in Europe or move to Europe or whatever. So, so there's a, this kind of weird confrontational approach he's taking, which is very Trumpy. And of course, it's Bolsonaro. You know, there's a whole lineup, isn't there, globally, of these authoritarian
Netanyahu,
and they all love each other, they all, they're all on the phone to each other, and they seem to enjoy each other's company, but they have all destabilized the world in different ways, in different environments, different regions, but they've all had that impact. And certainly if we could have one less, particularly in such a powerful country like that, it, it would be a very positive development.
Yeah. Well, thanks for highlighting that, because I, that was not on my radar, and now it is, and it should be. So I want to talk about, it's time to talk about Doomsday Watch.
Okay.
Again, you know, I said it very muddledly up front, but I think what you're doing is really important, because this, this season, I hate to use that word, I wish there was a better word, but of the pod is really a history of the war. And I think it's so important to do that. And as a, as an artifact historically, because, you know, I majored in history, you know, people go back and they read things that people wrote about, you know, the Roman Empire and Tacitus and all this stuff, but we're not limited to just word, to just words. Now we can have all of this other stuff. And I think it's just great to package it in that way, to make people, you know, now, but also in the future, be able to go and listen to the podcast and understand what happened. So how did this idea come to you, this this particular twist on the podcast? What was the
well first thank you, and I'm really delighted that you know you're kind of you're enjoying it. The idea kind of came, the producer I work with, Robin, and I, we were talking about kind of great, really sort of classic TV documentary series of from our childhood. We both grew up in the 1980s in the UK, and there was a show called The World at War, which was a history of World War II. This is, of course, in an era when there were three channels or four channels on TV, and you know, so there wasn't that, you didn't have much choice. If this was on, you were going to watch it. And it had a huge impact. It really defined the way that people thought about World War II. And of course, in the 80s, you, a lot of veterans were obviously still in good health and all the rest of it. And it was, it had quite a kind of somber style and quite a kind of quite serious, I mean, not over serious, but a serious tone equal to the seriousness of the content. And in fact, the narrative was, the voiceover was Laurence Olivier, you know, the great actor. So it was, it, it, it's, I think you can find it on YouTube, The World at War. It's kind of worth looking at. And we felt it would be, without being over ambitious or sort of overly hubristic, we kind of felt that that was the vibe that we would try to go for as something that would hopefully stand the test of time, that people might come back to in a few years and sort of and pick it up and create this kind of narrative history. Now, of course, the big difference, World at War was being done about 40 years after the events. Right. We're doing it 1 year, so it's very much a first draft of history. There'll be things that maybe 20 years from now people will take a different opinion on, but trying to treat it in this kind of grand historical view rather than more kind of reportage of just, you know, things that have just happened and that kind of stuff.
No, I think it's a great idea, and I'm really glad you're doing it. And I think it's, you know, having the first draft is important. I mean, mm-hmm. a couple weeks ago, I bought a book at the book fair called Fascism, and it was right. about the rise of Mussolini, written in like 1950 by an Italian wow. historian. So it was, wow. you know, so I read, and it's slim volume. So I read mm-hmm. through it, and amazing. They get all of it. And you there's more there than probably people realize now about
yeah.
the internal Italian politics and stuff like that.
Right.
Lots of stuff that I'm like, oh, that's Trump. That's Trump. That's Trump. You know,
right.
but that draft of things, I think is, you know, it's just really important. So talk a little bit about who's in this, who do you interview, yeah. you know, all of that. What's the process?
Yeah. So so part of it is sort of set around the structure of the first episode tries to go right back, you know, way back into, the sort of deep history. And of course, as everyone will be well aware, you know, Putin's done this too. You know, I mean, he wrote this weird essay where he kind of talks about the Vikings coming to what is now Ukraine and so on. But in a way, you have to kind of engage with that stuff. Obviously, that Putin's telling of it is extremely one-sided. Well, yeah. one-sided is putting it generously. I mean, it's probably no-sided. But anyway, it's but I feel that you have to sort of engage with that. So the first episode, we go right back into that, and we've got some great voices. There are some Ukrainian historians. So in fact, there's a guy called Vladimir Nenko, who is actually, he's now a professor in Oxford University, but he's born quite near Mariupol. And so you get that combination where someone has a deep professional, you know, context, but also a highly personal relationship with the subject. And then the first episode. And as we go on, we take some of it is sort of fairly chronological narrative, and some of it is more is kind of on a subject basis. So we had an episode, I think it was episode 3, which was really focused on the Russian war crimes, you know, which is,
yeah.
unfortunately, is really the Russian way that war happens. And you know, you can look back in the history, World War II, Chechnya, Syria, you know, this keeps happening. It's not a one-off thing. And for that episode, we were able to speak to various people. I had John Sweeney, who's a great British yeah. War correspondent, he's basically been in Kyiv since the beginning. He got there in I think it was the middle of February, so just before the invasion, and he's been there ever since. But he was reporting in Chechnya in 2000. So he's somebody who's been kind of on this beat for a long time. But we also spoke to Ukrainian Yevgeny Maloletka, who... he was the last photographer in Mariupol when the city was surrounded by Russians and effectively being, you know, being destroyed utterly and you know, with no regard for civilian casualties. So that, I mean, that was a very powerful and quite difficult interview to do, because Yevgeny is clearly very, as you would expect, you know, very deeply affected by his experiences from last year. So it's been that mixture of people who are kind of eyewitnesses to events. We've got another one is a young man who was a frontline soldier, you know, a volunteer. He's actually from Georgia, and there's a so-called Georgian Legion, because quite a lot of Georgians, because of Russia having invaded their country, have gone to fight in Ukraine. And you've got people like that whose engagement with this is visceral and firsthand, and then people who are the analysts, the academics, the experts. And so it's that getting that kind of mixture has been important. And then the final thing is creating, I mean, this is very much the producer, not me, but creating a kind of an audio environment. So it's quite sort of heavily produced. We've got a lot of, we're using quite a lot of, sort of classical music, quite kind of hefty kind of musical in, landscape, I guess. And I think that gives it that feeling of something which is, it's not ephemeral, you know, it's something you feel that might be listened to a few years from now.
Heavy on the Mahler, it's good. Mm. Sweeney, I believe my friend Zarina Zabriskie, yeah, who's been on my pod a couple of times, she's there, yeah, reporting Keeve. I think she knows him. And right, I remember the photographer from Mariupol, that when those photos came out on, right, Twitter, that was a big deal. Yeah.
He took that famous, awful, famous picture in the maternity hospital after it had been bombed. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, later on, the Russians said that it was all faked, and they pretended that this was some kind of actor who'd, you know, put on a fat suit to look like they were pregnant or whatever. I mean, you know, they're just the depth of the cynicism of bombing a maternity hospital and then trying to kind of fake the incident. I mean, it's just,
mind-boggling. Horrible. Yeah. So again, it's Doomsday Watch. Please subscribe to it, listen to it. Even if you don't do it right now, come back to it, because I think this is going to be, obviously, this is a hugely important story, not just for Russia and Ukraine, but for the United States, for Great Britain, for everywhere. I mean, this is, in my view, it is the forces of democracy against the forces of fascism in a very clear way. And wars are often very complicated in terms of who's fighting who and why, and this one is not complicated in my view. It's just, you know, a Hitlerian dictator trying to invade and take over a sovereign nation that he has no right to do. So and doing it in a genocidal horrific way. So what's your sense now of what's happening in Ukraine? I mean, because it feels like, I mean, Putin could stop the war tomorrow, obviously, but he's not going to. I think he's going to maybe continue to double down until he runs out of people, and he's got a lot of people. And the Ukrainians obviously are not going to surrender or ceasefire or any of that. So what do you think is going to happen? Do you have any sense at all? I mean, what's the...
Yeah, well, so I went to Ukraine just about a month ago. So just while we were sort of starting the production on this new series, and I was lucky because I was kind of I managed to kind of tag on to a delegation that was meeting some quite sort of high level people. I came away with some possibly quite conflicting perceptions. So one is that there is a lot of focus on the Ukrainian counteroffensive, which, you know, we keep saying it's about to begin and hasn't quite begun, but it's going to happen at some point this year. But in Ukraine, I think there's a bit of nervousness that they see that Westerners are hoping that this is kind of the end of the war. And of course, in the movie, it would be, right? That there'd be this big counteroffensive, mm-hmm, and they'd drive the Russians off and it would all be heroic. But of course, in real life is more complicated than that. And what they are saying is that yes, they've done lots of training and they've got brigades ready to go, and of course they've got new tanks from Europe and America and elsewhere, and new weapons and so on. But that may not be everything, you know. And Russia has this willingness because it puts no value on human life. Basically, right, it has this willingness to just go on and on. And so what they say is that the Russians can't really advance, but they can defend. And in a way, that's quite tough for the Ukrainians, because the Ukrainians need to make big advances just to reclaim the territory. But coming back really to your point, Greg, which I couldn't agree more, that this is an uncomplicated war. You know, this is, it's very simple in a kind of moral way. But I guess that there's another point which is related that I would make, which is that also, you know, basically since the end of World War II, free countries, particularly in North America and Europe, have planned for the possibility of a war with Russia. Now, it's not a war that we wanted, but we knew it was a possibility and we planned for it. And the weird thing is that war has now happened, but it turned out that they did it against Ukraine. But it is definitely that war, because if Russia wins this war, Europe can't be at peace. You know, I mean, it's and to get to Ukraine, you have to fly to Poland and then you take a train because there's no flights into Ukraine. And you really get that when, as soon as you get to Poland, you realize that you're in a kind of frontline state. And I don't mean that in, you know, Poland these days is a very kind of modern, sophisticated country. It feels very like a country on the move, basically. But there's a lot of sort of military, there's a lot of security, there's a lot of Ukraine flags everywhere. And it's just this very heightened sense that Europe's war is happening just over the border. So I think Europe particularly, and actually this is where even as someone, as a Brit, I'm a very pro-European Brit, but you know, Europe needs to get better at supplying Ukraine with weapons, at producing. Because one of the things is, you know, across the Western world, we've all got complacent, you know, our factories don't make munitions at the quantity needed. You know, just so one of the things I heard the Ukrainians saying was, it's even if you guys decide to support us, we don't know if you've got the capacity to do it, you know. And so the Ukrainians are trying to develop their own military tech, and certain areas, I think they're going to overtake all of us. So in like drone technology, because they've used drones so much, and it's an interesting thought that, you know, if Ukraine wins this war, you'll have a large country on the eastern side of Europe with a huge military, very advanced military technology. And in some respects, it'll be like a supersized Israel. It'll be this country that has fought for its own survival and kind of doesn't take any shit from anyone. And of course, that's complicated. I mean, in both good and bad ways, you know, Israel is a complicated country to grapple with. So I think there are lots of aspects to this that we have to start trying to think about and just, you know, beyond the immediate framework of the next 12 months, which I think partly because of the political cycle in America, I know that people are very focused on that. And of course, you know, again, Ukrainians are very nervous about a Republican president, because that for them is a game changer in a negative direction.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought about that. You know, them having a super powerful military. No nukes, though.
Yeah. No.
Not yet. Presumably, if they can figure this stuff out. And you mentioned the drones. They have very sophisticated drones, Arthur. I mean, Vladimir Putin said that there was a drone that came to the Kremlin and tried to kill him.
Oh, well, that's right. Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So I'm sure he wasn't lying, you know?
No, indeed. I mean, that's a weird one, isn't it? Because sometimes with these kind of Russian, you know, fake news and propaganda stories, you're trying to get inside the heads of this deeply paranoid state that is sort of collapsing in on itself and losing a war. And yeah, I'm, you know, like most people, I find it very unlikely that the Ukrainians would have done that. But then you start to think, well, if the Russians did it to prove a point, like what the hell is the point they're trying to prove? Because it's a really, you know, to prove that your Kremlin is so badly defended that a crappy little drone can, you know, attack it. It's
a, like, really a paper air. Somebody threw a paper airplane is what happened, and they mistook it for a
That's right.
I don't now. On the topic of Ukraine, I've had on my show Victor Rudd, who's a Ukraine expert here in the U.S., and he's been yelling, arguing for years that the way that in China they will look at the way that the West responds to Crimea in particular, and now, you know, Russia taking Ukraine, and get ideas about Taiwan.
Yeah.
And I had a former diplomat from Australia on the show, on the podcast last week, and I asked him about this because he was in China for 5 years or whatever. That's where he was stationed. And he said, and I thought this was interesting, after Crimea, yes, that they looked at it probably and thought, okay, we can make this happen.
Yeah.
But now that Russia has invaded and it's a complete shit show and the West is completely unified and pushing back and all this terrible stuff has happened, probably Beijing is like, we don't want that. You know, we're not going to make that mistake. So maybe in some roundabout way, it's it's an object lesson rather than a green light, I guess.
I think that's definitely true. And I mean, it's a reminder that a determined defense is pretty hard to dislodge, and particularly if you're kind of a peer, you know, sort of roughly peer nation in terms of your equipment, maybe not in scale, but in terms of the level of your equipment. And of course, I'm sure your Australian friend talked about this, you know, the challenge of invading Taiwan, you know, it would be like the D-Day landings, you know, all over again. And that was, you know, that was not an easy job. No. So it's definitely a really, it's a major undertaking, but for China. And I think that sort of explains, I think the realization in Beijing that Taiwan is not a straightforward objective, and that actually a lot of countries might help and make it really difficult for them, I think that may reflect the kind of worsening of China-USA relations, because the Chinese feeling this kind of frustration, which of course I'm reasonably happy that they feel frustrated, but this annoyance and frustration that this thing that they sort of felt was going to work out for them might not be so straightforward. And of course, the other thing then you see that comes out of that, which is happening now, is the Chinese becoming more active on the so-called peace negotiation. Now, these are, they're not, again, it's the same peace program that Erdogan's got, which is telling the Ukrainians to stop fighting to defend their own territory, which is, that's one version of peace, but it doesn't really work for most people. So Xi Jinping appears to have sort of tried to push that on Zelensky, and I think actually the Ukrainians were a bit surprised by that. I think they didn't. I mean, they knew that China was being very supportive to Russia, but they didn't realize how little China understood about Ukraine's determination to defend itself. And in a way, sometimes we overrate, I think, China's level of understanding. You know, yes, on certain things, they probably know everything there is to know. But I think sometimes they've failed because they see things from their own, as we all do, they see things from their own perspective, and they failed to see what it's like to be a smaller country being invaded by a larger country, and what that would mean, basically.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. So this is, I feel like that's a hopeful thing. You mentioned the bit about peace and, oh, we should have peace. This is something that like Rand Paul and Tulsi Gabbard and people like that. We have these politicians who like to go out and say, well, I'm just anti-war. No one's for war. No one wants to be at war, but it's like when you're demanding peace and coming to the negotiation table, what you're demanding is Ukrainian surrender of territory.
Exactly. Exactly.
So sit down, Roger Waters. That's why nobody's going to your concert.
But what the hell happened with Roger? It's so annoying when someone who, you know, that you've enjoyed as an artist turns out to be a real moron. But there you go. But no, I mean, that crowd is here in the UK, tends to be in the UK more on the hard left. So like Jeremy Corbyn, people associated with his crowd. And again, I mean, it's so bizarre because the one thing that those people have certainly devoted their lives to, and one can debate whether it's good or bad, but they've devoted their lives to this kind of anti-imperial struggle. Mm-hmm. And if you can't look at what Russia's doing and see it as an imperial war of expansion, you are blind. I mean, it's so blatantly obvious. But, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, no, he doesn't get it. He thinks that there should be an immediate ceasefire, and then let's negotiate. And okay, great. Well, then that's a surrender by Ukraine, and you negotiate. As I was told when I was there, it's a third of our territory and 1 million people living under Russian occupation. And that's 1 million because there were many more than that, but a lot are dead or have escaped to avoid living under Russian subjugation. So, you know, I mean, I don't know how anyone can look at the images of a city like Mariupol completely flattened and then say, well, there should be a negotiation to do what? You know, I mean, it's hard to believe that these people don't have some other motives in play.
Yeah. Or they're just apparently, in the case of Roger Waters, you know, maybe he really did need education. and
yeah, I know.
Control,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe he should have listened to the teachers. So where can we find you online? Tell everybody where we can find you.
Okay, so the Doomsday Watch podcast should be easily found on any of the normal podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify, all those great places. I'm on Twitter at Snell Arthur, and I also have started a Substack where I write about, I suppose, big global affairs. And again, that's arthursnell.substack.com.
I didn't know you had a Substack. Okay.
Please take a look at that. And at the moment, at least, it's still... It's free to all comers because I've only just got going. So now's the time. Get in early.
This is great. Arthur Snell, thanks so much for taking time. Always great to talk to you.
Yeah, likewise, Greg. It was a pleasure.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Kost, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John, Tally Briggs, Michelle Cantor, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. And until next time, we shall prevail.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.